Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The not guilty verdict in the trial of Roberto Miramontes Roman, for the murder of Millard County Deputy Sheriff Josie Greathouse Fox shocked many in the community. And now some of the jurors are talking about their deliberations. This case got us wondering, how do juries come to their decisions? What influences those decisions? And can we have confidence in our jury system? On the program today, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Falk, who's been talking with some of those jurors, and with University of Texas Associate Professor of Sociology and Law, Mary Rose, who has studied how juries reach decisions. We'll also ask you to call or email us your experience serving on a jury, if you've had that experience, and we'll ask you if that experience gave you more or less confidence in our jury system. The number to call is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, and the email is upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. We welcome in Mary Rose from University of Texas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
We'll be interested in speaking to you. You've studied many of the issues we want to talk about today, including, a landmark study of decision-making among juries in Pima County, Arizona, and the whole lay participation in the justice system. We'll get to that a little bit later. We want to get the facts in this case, and we bring in for that Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Falk. Aaron Falk, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Maybe first of all, as a preface, is this usual in your experience? Jurors, are they anxious to talk to the media, reticent? What was your experience trying to get to these jurors?
Usually, I would say not so. I wouldn't say the jurors in this case were necessarily anxious. I certainly sought them out, and the night of the acquittal, they were not very interested in talking at all. I spoke with one juror, but most left without saying anything. In most cases, I would say it's relatively unusual to have so many jurors speak mm-hmm. with me.
As we go along, we'll talk about what the importance of that, perhaps the public in large being able to get into the jurors' minds, and that might affect perceptions of whether or not justice was done. Maybe you could outline in brief the facts of the case. We know that tragically a Millard County deputy sheriff was killed. I think this was January of 2010.
It was January 5th, just about 1 o'clock in the morning, January 5th, outside of Delta in central Utah. Deputy Fox was contacted by her sergeant to stop a Cadillac that her sergeant had seen. It got stopped with another vehicle on a rural road in the county, and she was ordered to stop that Cadillac, and she spoke on the radio saying she was making a stop, and that was the last that anyone heard of her. She was shot twice and found about 9 minutes later lying on the road.
And there were two men out there on that road, at least at one point. One of them, unbelievably, the deputy's brother.
Yeah, her brother, Ryan Greathouse, was involved with a drug deal on that road. That's what sparked this traffic stop. He was purchasing drugs from Mr. Roman.
And what did the prosecution say? What did they say happened there?
At that point, they say that that Greathouse drove one way and Roman drove another. They said Roman became angry when he saw Deputy Fox's lights in his rearview mirror, and that he shot her twice with the AK-47. After she was found, deputies went to the brother's home and found him there and informed him of the death, and that's when they say they started the search for Mr. Roman.
And eventually found Mr. Roman, in Beaver County, I believe.
Yeah, Mr. Roman and another friend, Ruben Chavez Reyes, went north to Salt Lake City, where they were nearly found by police, and after that they took a number of different types of transportation south to Beaver County, and they were eventually arrested sleeping in a shed in Beaver County, hoping to flee to Mexico.
And apparently Mr. Roman confessed to the murder to Beaver County officials?
He did. In Beaver County jail, speaking with Utah County officials, there was some overlap with different law enforcement agencies, but he made a confession, and at trial he later recanted that confession, saying that in fact Deputy Fox's brother Ryan Greathouse had shot her, and that he agreed in the heat of a moment to take the fall for that killing, and that the brother had later threatened his family if he did not follow through with that agreement.
Apparently, Mr. Rahman's testimony in his own defense at trial apparently was quite effective.
Certainly, in speaking with the jurors I was able to talk to, they said he was very, very convincing, and that played a large part in their decision to acquit.
What was the defense's theory?
The defense throughout trial said very little. I mean, there were times they didn't cross-examine witnesses. One of the jurors I spoke with said he thought that was a very effective technique, kind of less is more. And they put on one witness, and that was the defendant himself, who testified that he was driving the car, and Ryan Greathouse was in the passenger seat. They stopped when the deputy pulled them over, and Ryan Greathouse fired the AK-47, and they heard a woman scream. At that point, Mr. Rahman said that's when they knew it was a woman, and that's when Ryan Greathouse said that he had shot his sister. Obviously, the prosecution tried to debunk that that testimony, basically saying that there was no way that is what happened.
And Mr. Rahman is asserting that he was threatened by Mr. Greathouse threatening his family if he didn't take the fall for this murder.
Certainly, that's why he said that he made the confession to the Utah County deputies that he spoke with. I guess a day after the shooting when he was arrested.
And we should say that Mr. Greathouse, quite soon after, died in Las Vegas of a drug overdose.
I believe it was about 4 months after his sister was killed.
Yeah, so he is gone. So the jury, who were you able to talk to on the jury?
I spoke with three people. The jury forewoman, her name is Nicole Kay. This is a Utah County jury. They moved the venue because the defense didn't think they would be able to get a fair trial in Millard County. So I spoke with the forewoman, a man named Gary Cooper, who's a realtor in Utah County, and a BYU law student named Jared Trent, who was on the jury as well.
Now, when they went in, took the initial poll, it was, I believe, 5-3 in favor of conviction.
Correct. They started off just saying, you know, if we had to do this right now, what would it be? And I guess so. From the beginning, there were doubts, although certainly more than not would have voted for guilty.
Hmm. And as they went along, finally they ended up near the end of the process, an exact reversal of that vote in favor of acquittal.
Sure, and I guess one by one, people started to change their minds, and this deliberations lasted about 8.5 hours that night, mm-hmm. and by about 8 hours, it was 7-1 with the forewoman, Nicole Kay, being the lone holdout, and I guess at that point she said it was a pretty tense situation, and there was a lot of pressure for her to change her vote.
And what did she say? She apparently has regrets. You write in your story every day since the trial, she has regrets that she didn't extend this at least to the next day. Why did she say she changed her vote?
It was getting late. I mean, this was. They went into deliberations about 3 o'clock, and like I said, the deliberations lasted a total of 8.5 hours. Throughout this, they sent a note back to the judge asking, you know, how long should we continue if we can't reach a unanimous decision? And at the end, the judge is asking them, you know, are you reaching something, or should we come back tomorrow? And there was a lot of pressure to, at least according to her, to change the vote. They were saying that after 8.5 hours, if there were still doubts, then that must mean there was reasonable doubt in the case and that the prosecution didn't do its job. And there was also pressure for her. I mean, people were tired. People didn't want to come back. They'd been there for a week. They would have had to come back on a Saturday. There were talks of an older woman on the jury who they were concerned with just making the drive to and from the courthouse to where she lived in farther away in Utah County. I mean, there were a number of things that Ms. Kay said played a factor, and kind of, she said, pressured her into a decision.
Mr. Cooper was interesting as well. He basically, I guess, says he could have gone either way, and if the rest of you jurors want to go for acquittal, then, hey, I'll go along.
Yeah, that was kind of his stance throughout. He did say that, you know, if he had to do it over again without some other evidence or without a different process or a different set of jurors, he would have acquitted again. But he throughout was kind of trying to just work towards consensus. In his words, he thought that here was a man who was Mr. Roman, who was admitted drug dealer, drug user. He had a gun he should not have had, and he possibly could have at least in his storyline, possibly could have prevented the shooting either way. So, I mean, given those things, Mr. Cooper said he wouldn't have had a problem finding him guilty and sending him to prison, even if there were maybe some doubts in his mind.
There were a couple of jurors, apparently, who from the outset were at least had doubts about the case, and as it went along, were the key pushers toward acquittal.
Sure, there was a theater professor, and according to Mr. Cooper and Ms. Kay, there was a law student, Jared Trent, who was by his own admission, the word he used was instrumental in getting this acquittal, and he had doubts from the outset. He didn't believe that the prosecution and the police had done enough to eliminate Ryan Greathouse, the brother, as a suspect in the case, and he had questions about some of the evidence, and he was not about to change his mind throughout the 8.5 hours.
And at least one of the jurors you interviewed, I think this is Gary Cooper, he was angered by the sound quality of that confession, that they didn't have what they needed there.
Yeah, the confession in Beaver County was recorded both audio and video. It was high definition video, but the audio, the microphone, was placed in the ceiling near an air vent. And throughout, there are large portions of this interview that are inaudible. They try to improve the quality to enhance that, and even with the transcript, I mean, there were a lot of holes to fill in, and they were really frustrated with that. So it became a matter of Roman's words on the stand, which in the juror's estimation was pretty convincing, compared to a really broken up recording from the Beaver County Sheriff's Office that left them with a lot of questions that couldn't be answered other than through the testimony of the police who conducted those interviews.
Reading your story, the thing I keyed in on was just the emotional toll this takes. Having the weight of this on your shoulders, I think it's Nicole Kay who said that she, during deliberations, would look out the window. She could see the Greathouse family there. That really weighed on her.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once the jurors heard that this was going to be it was initially scheduled for 2 weeks and ended up being about a week. But once they heard it was going to be a lengthy trial, they knew something was that it was a serious case. And this is Josie Fox was the only female peace officer in Utah to ever be killed in the line of duty. Her family was there. People from the sheriff's office were there supporting her during the trial. Pat Finlinson, the prosecutor, is from that county. You could tell he was very emotional about the whole thing, and throughout the whole week, it was obviously a very serious, very somber affair for everybody, and certainly for the jurors.
And several jurors focused on Mr. Finlinson and his disappointment at the verdict.
Absolutely, this is a case that was Deputy Fox was killed 2.5 years ago. This is a case that has been a top priority for that county since then. They went into the trial hoping for some justice, hoping for closure, and in talking with people after the fact, they feel that they were cheated of that. They feel that the system let them down this time.
Of course, the defense attorneys would have different emotion. The jury didn't seem to be focusing on them. I guess maybe it would be different if the verdict had gone the other way. I don't know.
Sure. You know, it's tough. I mean, the defense was, you know, the defense has a duty to defend Mr. Roman, and they did that vigorously, and obviously, successfully, there were doubts in the juror's mind and sent it in an acquittal.
We just have another couple of minutes left in this segment, and then if Mr. Falk, if you need to go, we'll let you go. Mr. Cooper had a very interesting reaction to all this. He says he's able to sleep at night because, sure, they may have let a murderer go. You know, he doesn't know, but it's God's justice that ultimately will prevail here, and that's his attitude.
Sure, that was something I guess he'd said. I guess a couple of times throughout the deliberations, and specifically to Nicole Kay, the lone holdout at the end, toward the end of the night, he said, you know, I'm whether to convince her or not, just giving her his take that he believed in a higher power, and that if there was going to be, if they were in fact going to make a mistake here, there would be a way to reconcile that, I guess in another life, which gave him some comfort.
Finally, Mr. Falk, I don't know, have you interviewed other juries?
Just in general?
In general, yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah, I've interviewed other jurors.
This seems like a pretty unusual case.
I think so. I think the circumstances, the fact that so many, that Mr. Greathouse wasn't alive to defend himself and his statements weren't admissible based on hearsay, because he wasn't able to be questioned again by defense. There were a number of things that didn't happen in this case. The recording, when the traffic, what the initial contact between what prosecutors said was Mr. Greathouse and Mr. Roman, and the two cars separate in the night. A sheriff sergeant follows or tells Josie to follow the Cadillac. Meanwhile, the Greathouse truck is leaving. And instead of following the Greathouse truck, they'd been scoping out the area for burglaries. They see some lights down at the end of the road. They follow it to the end of the road. It turns out to be someone moving hay in the middle of the night in Millard County. And if they would have stopped the Greathouse truck immediately, they would have known one way or another who was in that car. Josie's dash cam wasn't working. I mean, for these jurors, there was a lot of things that didn't happen, and I think Gary Cooper said the stars kind of aligned here, that possibly, I think he said someone who was very likely a murderer was allowed to walk free.
Well, a very interesting case. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Mary Rose, University of Texas, associate professor of sociology and law. We'll get into larger issues here on how much confidence we should have in our jury system, lay participation in the legal process, and how juries reach their decisions. We're going to want to hear from you as well. If you've served on a jury, what was that experience like, and did that give you more or less confidence in our jury system at the end of it? Aaron Falk, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And a quick break back with Mary Rose on this subject and your calls and emails as well.
Regional correspondents on Utah Public Radio provide that unique link that makes UPR's statewide news coverage your favorite resource for news. Hi, I'm Mackenzie Hamilton. Join me each evening during All Things Considered at 5:30 for expanded Utah news. UPR has a one-of-a-kind network with reporters from Southern Utah, the Uinta Basin, Moab, and Utah County. It's the only way of providing you with the views and news that you need to make informed decisions. Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Bonnie Plants, plant growers since 1918, dedicated to sharing a love of gardening to help people become successful and productive vegetable and herb gardeners. Information is at bonnieplants.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the verdict in the trial of Roberto Miramontes Roman for the murder of Millard County Deputy Sheriff Josie Greathouse Fox. It's a case that I think many of us in Utah have been following ever since it happened in January of 2010. Now the trial has happened, and a not guilty verdict was certainly a surprise to many and has shocked the community. Our Attorney General Mark Shurtleff expressed outrage, and I think that's the the attitude of probably many in the community. That got us thinking, how do jurors reach their decisions? And we're going to ask you, if you've ever served on a jury, what was the experience like? The number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. And you can email us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. We now bring in Mary Rose, Associate Professor of Sociology and Law at University of Texas. She studies lay participation in the legal system and also has studied juries and jury decision-making, including a landmark study of decision-making among 50 deliberating juries from Pima County, Arizona. Mary Rose, thanks for being patient through the other other conversation. We wanted to set the facts of the case, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
So just your reaction to this case. Is this unusual? Are there themes here that fit into others that you've examined?
Well, I think Mr. Falk outlined the way in which the evidence in the case is unusual, that there were some really grave challenges that the prosecution faced in presenting a coherent account and a really full account of their theory of what happened that night. I don't know that it's that unusual in the way the jury responded to the information that they were given. You really have to put yourself in the mind of someone who's in the trial, who is being instructed to have a very high standard for proof and being convinced of guilt, and as only given particular kinds of pieces of evidence, and is instructed that if they read anything else about the case, to put that aside and just focus on what they heard in the courtroom. So everything that I'm hearing is that the jurors in that case, with some reservations and some ambivalence, stuck to the evidence that they had and paid a lot of attention to the very high standard that they're given to make decisions by, that is, beyond a reasonable doubt.
I want to follow up on that, beyond a reasonable doubt. This jury seemed to have they had a debate over what reasonable doubt meant, but we want to bring in a caller. Let's bring in Betty from Washington. Betty, go ahead with your question or comment.
Several years ago, I served on juries, I think, three different times, and one was very interesting because it was a federal court, and the cases involved things that local courts don't usually handle. One was actually a gun running case where this guy was pushing guns from Canada. It was a number of years ago. It was fairly well known that he was a part of a paramilitary group, but that couldn't come out in the testimony. And so we had to narrow our focus, and I think maybe that's kind of like what this jury did. They had to narrow their focus to what were the facts of this particular charge. And we had to do that, too. And we had holdouts finding the guy not guilty because people knew that he was doing stuff illegal with guns. But what it ended up was that we had to say that the government had entrapped him and had kind of forced him to sell them guns that he might not have done otherwise, and so he was found innocent. But the one of the interesting things about that case was that all of this man's supporters were in the court. I'm sorry, he was not found guilty of the greater charge. He was found guilty of a lesser charge. And the courtroom was packed with his supporters, and the judge knew that. So he held the courtroom until the jury could leave so that we wouldn't be threatened by those people.
You felt
it was pretty intense.
It sounds like it would be. Yep. So the follow-up question, does your experiences on a jury make you more or less confident in our jury system?
It actually made me very confident in the deliberation that we did and the fact that we did have holdouts and we were convinced, I was one of the holdouts, we were convinced that our prior knowledge or any other activities that he did not impact on this particular charge. And we narrowed our focus. another, you know, the other juries that I was on were just civil suits, civil cases, and they were also very interesting. And I don't know how they pick jurors, but I would love to serve on a jury now that I live in Utah, but I so far have not been called.
Okay. Thank you, Betty. Appreciate
You're
that.
You're welcome.
That's it. I don't know, Mary Rose, is that somewhat unusual? She's ready to go again, serve on a jury.
I have to say that is not unusual. Most of the research I've done on juries and former jurors and that exists in the literature suggests that jury service, while difficult, challenging, sometimes boring, whatever, you know, negatives, that they walk away with a greater understanding of the system, with some faith. The one thing to really keep in mind about what's very unique about our legal culture and about the United States is that the jury is an independent body that stands between an accused person and the government. That is the way we've set up our system. The founders were the biggest supporters of the jury system. If you look at the Bill of Rights, there's, you know, 10 amendments. Three of them mention the word jury, including the Fifth Amendment on a grand jury, the Sixth Amendment on a criminal jury, and a Seventh Amendment on the civil jury. They, you know, of all the issues they had to decide, they made sure that a jury was an important part of our original liberties. And that's because they understood that without a truly independent body making these kinds of decisions, there's always risk for corruption. There's always a risk that somebody has their, you know, hand on the scale for one team. You know, if you work for the government, if you're the judge, or if you're a body that's been hired and paid by the state, it's just very hard to feel that you truly are independent. And we give the jury an enormous amount of independence. They don't have to explain their decisions. They didn't have to talk to reporters. They're not accountable. And I think that's a very powerful thing in a democracy to experience firsthand and realize you're on a level playing field with the judge. You are allowed to say what you think is right and what you think makes sense given the evidence. And I think people find that a very empowering experience by and large, even if, as these jurors undoubtedly felt, it's a grave responsibility.
We're talking about the Roberto Miramontes Roman acquittal for the murder of Millard County Deputy Sheriff Josie Greathouse Fox. It's a case that's gotten a great deal of publicity in Utah, both the events and the death, tragic death of Deputy Fox, and also now the trial, which has shocked many in the community. And that gives us an occasion to talk about our jury system, lay participation in the legal system, and how juries reach their decisions. And we'd love to hear your jury experience. Just call us at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, toll-free. And you can email us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. I do have an email I'll get to in just a moment. I want to talk maybe a bit about you've talked about the strengths of the jury system,
mm-hmm.
Some downsides, and one here that maybe was highlighted in my mind was the debate the jury had over and possible misunderstanding, I don't know, of what constitutes reasonable doubt. In this case, they were, you know, some of the jurors were saying, well, if you have, you know, evidence for reasonable doubt is right here in front of us. We can't reach a conviction. So that's reasonable doubt, which perhaps if they deliberated another day or two, they might have gone the other way.
Well, I think it's important to remember that juries hear only the most difficult cases. You know, the percentage of cases that go before juries in, as the number of filings is around 2% or less. I mean, they're hearing the really, really tip of the iceberg case. These are the ones that didn't settle if it's a civil case or didn't plead out if it's a criminal case. And that meant the defense has a feeling that they have a case for reasonable doubt, that there's something about the evidence that's the jury's going to hear, that they can make a case for reasonable doubt. Is it going to be necessarily the strong one, the best one? You know, we don't know until we have the trial. But the instructions do not lay out exactly what reasonable doubt is. They never say, you are to define reasonable doubt as this. Instead, what they do is give that instruction to a group of people who come from all walks of life, or certainly very diverse walks of life, and they leave it to them to understand what doubt means for them, what reasonable doubt means for them, and what it means to have that proven beyond so that it is eliminated. And I think it's not surprising that you could have a group of eight people who disagree during the case about what constitutes a reasonable doubt. Because, again, it's not formulaic. If it were formulaic, we wouldn't need juries. It's not a number that you can quantify very easily, and people are to bring their experience and their common sense, and I think you would have a diversity of opinion. And I think it would be very challenging.
I wonder about this pressure. In high-stakes cases like this, there's probably always going to be pressure. And as we read about this jury's deliberation, Mr. Falk's article here in the Tribune, there was intense pressure, it seems like. And the forewoman, Nicole Kay, does apparently have regrets about the way she voted now.
Yeah, and I find that's very sad to hear about for her. That must be a very challenging position to feel like. We won't ever know what would have happened the next morning if she'd had a night to sleep on it, if others had had a night to sleep on it and come back. We just won't know. I don't know that it's fair to assume that another day would have shifted the other seven the other way. So that I think what we're talking about is the difference between an acquittal and a hung jury. Mm-hmm. Hung juries are pretty rare, about 6% of cases end in hung verdicts. But they happen because groups can't always agree, can't come to consensus about these issues we've talked about. But when you start off with three people who sound pretty firm on their view of acquittal, I don't think we're talking about replaying it historically to end up in a conviction. I think we're talking about whether it would have been a hung jury.
Hmm. We're talking with Mary Rose, who's Associate Professor of Sociology and Law at the University of Texas, talking about the jury system and how juries work, how they reach their decisions is something that Mary Rose studies, lay participation in our legal system. And as Professor Rose has told us, this, we know, it was built into our Constitution. This was very much smiled upon by the founding fathers. Can we have confidence in our jury system? That's another question we're throwing out to you, and we especially want to get your jury experience and whether that made you more or less confident in the jury system, how you came out of that experience. The number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. The email is upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. We do have this email from Tracy in Ogden. He says, I was on federal jury duty in Salt Lake for 2 weeks in August into September, a tough time for an educator to be away from work. Even though I was having kidney stones, the judge made me stay. It was a bitter case over copyright between economists with millions of dollars in dispute. The jury was a mixed group of people, but we discovered connections and mutual friends, which is not uncommon in Utah. I felt that every juror did their part to find the truth and to make the verdict reflect the truth. We were swayed pretty early in the trial to the direction we eventually went. That's Tracy in Ogden.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that illustrates, judges sometimes are pretty tough. We make you serve even if you don't want to.
This is pretty much in our modern era about the only responsibility that we ask of our citizens. When you think about it, you have a responsibility to pay your taxes, which we do ask of everyone, and we have a lot of fights over that. And we ask for military conscription in times of the draft and war, which we've kind of eliminated because we have an all-volunteer army mostly. And that leaves jury service as the way to show your commitment to your community, to your commitment to the justice system, your commitment to making sure that you have a voice in this institution, this democracy. And so we do ask a lot of our citizens. There have been tremendous gains over the last few decades in trying to make it easier on people. They've shifted to one day, one trial systems. If you're not picked in one day, then you can go home. And, you know, tried to be attentive to how to make things easier on jurors. But generally, it is a service, and it's a duty that we ask of people.
And Tracy's point as well that all the jurors were very sincere. They wanted to find the truth. They felt like they did find the truth. I could imagine most jurors are very sincere, right? They really want to do a good job.
Absolutely. Again, both because they recognize what a big responsibility this is. Even if it is, you know, two litigants who are fighting over millions of dollars that you're not going to know in your you know, your everyday life, it's a big responsibility. And then only more so in criminal cases. And they take that very seriously. We don't, you know, the cases of, often the cases you read about of what we would call, quote-unquote, juror misconduct are them trying to get information to have a better decision. You know, they're checking the internet or they're looking up definitions in the dictionary when they shouldn't. You know, what you're seeing are people who are sometimes too devoted to finding to finding the truth. And thankfully that doesn't happen a lot, but it I think it reflects on the fact that people really want to do a good job.
Mm. Yeah, the one of the jurors here, this law student, a couple of the other jurors, I could detect a little bit of annoyance in their comments to Mr. Falk's story. They said he'd put himself forth as an expert. He's a law student, and they were kind of a little bit annoyed by that.
And I'm sure all the kinds of group dynamics we have in our everyday life with colleagues and in schools and organizations we belong to, you know, I'm sure those come out in jury rooms in all kinds of different ways, and that the stakes are very high. So I'm sure there's times when you have to deal with someone who's challenging. But the jury is, again, a group of equals. And hopefully the court has made them feel that way and recognized that their decision is based on the evidence and the instructions that the judge has given.
We'll be back with Mary Rose after a short break. We'll get her to talk about perceptions of justice. This is something that she studies as well with our lay participation in the justice system. Certainly, in this case, at least some in Utah are expressing their opinion that a miscarriage of justice was done. We'll talk a little bit about perceptions of justice when we come back with Mary Rose, Associate Professor of Sociology and Law, University of Texas. We're responding to the Roberto Roman not guilty verdict, which came down recently.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, they're not only forever friends, they're fabulous musicians. Something magical happens when sisters sing and play music together. I'm Dave Higgs, and we'll have sisters galore when the Stevens sisters and Cherry Holmes join us live on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio now makes it even easier to stay up to date with news at noon on Twitter. This is April Ashland, UPR's social media coordinator, inviting you to follow and join the conversation about politics, local, and statewide events by going to twitter.com/UtahPublicRadio.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. In this final segment, we're going to talk about perceptions of justice and some other topics. We're responding to the not guilty verdict in the trial of Roberto Miramontes Roman for the murder of Mildred County Deputy Sheriff Josie Greathouse Fox. It shocked many in the community. Some of the jurors have been talking to the press. Very interesting to peer a little bit inside their deliberations through Aaron Falk's article in the Salt Lake Tribune. And now we're talking with Mary Rose, who's Associate Professor of Sociology and Law at the University of Texas. She studied how juries reach decisions and the whole lay participation in our justice system. I wonder if you talk a little bit about perceptions of justice. Certainly a case that gets a lot of publicity like this, I think probably a lot of people go in with the assumption, he's guilty. And when a not guilty verdict comes out, they're shocked.
And we certainly seem to have a lot of those, at least, you know, pretty regularly, where there's something that has piqued the media's attention or has really affected a community in a strong way. And, you know, of course, it is challenging to have someone who you have strong suspicions is guilty, have them walk out of the courtroom a free person. At the same time, again, the system, I think we do understand the system set up to favor that because wrongful convictions are also very eroding to our sense of faith in the justice system and very difficult to do and undo and really cope with. And so, you know, we have this kind of lopsided system that tends to put the emphasis on being really sure of a conviction. And it's important, as we said, to keep in mind that the jury is bound by what they hear in court and not by all the certainties that we have from what we heard. And that's as it should be. That's, you know, we want the jury to be considering the evidence that has been vetted and is appropriate and is not based on rumor or speculation. And the result is sometimes one of these ones that's very head-scratching, but it is consistent with the notion of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you, I don't know if you've encountered other jurors, you must have to have something to cope with the pressure. I could imagine myself, I've never served on a jury, you know, I'm willing to, but do my civic duty. But in a pressure like this, when you have, you know, a man's life in your hands, Mr. Cooper's comment, I think, was very telling. He said, well, I don't know if we did right here. We did our best, and now it's in God's hands.
Yeah, I think that's one advantage of a group decision, that you do know that you share the responsibility. Courts are becoming more aware of this kind of stress. Some places will offer debriefing. You know, it's especially difficult for juries if not only do they have a very emotional trial, as this one undoubtedly was, but you might have a case with gruesome evidence or something that they have to process that's very, very difficult for them to, you know, to cope with and kind of feeling face-to-face with evil. And so we've gotten more sensitive to the fact that this is very unique experience for people, one that is hard for their families maybe to understand what they went through, hard for people who weren't right there in that group. And I can only encourage courts to continue to, you know, make sure that they're doing everything they can to help jurors who are feeling that burden and feeling that stress.
We have another caller, Karen in Logan. Karen, glad you called. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. I had a comment, actually, and it was regarding something that you were saying. You pointed out that you'd never done jury duty, and there's a reason for it, and that's that something like approximately 95% of cases never go to trial. And I think a lot of people don't consider what that means. It means that the vast majority of defendants never have their day in court. And my family has recently been through a jury trial. My son was accused of a crime. And, you know, a lot of us have an idea that the police are very careful in their investigation, but my son was never interviewed, ever, at any time, by a police officer. He was accused, and then he had a public defender, and he never saw the public defender, never spoke with the public defender, never saw them. And eventually we were able to hire a private attorney. But once we'd done that, the police weren't interested in an interview. And the prosecutor wasn't interested in actually doing anything from my son's point of view to hear any other side of the story. So we eventually went to a jury trial. And the jury trial turned out to be our only hope of actually getting the facts of the case out there. That was our last hope.
So you're very glad you had that option.
Very much so. Very much so. I think that most Americans aren't aware of how plea bargains work in the United States. They don't realize that. The overwhelming pressure is to take a plea.
And that's become more common over time. If you compare the percent of cases that went to juries in both civil and criminal cases in, say, the 1960s to now, you have what's called the vanishing trial, because both bench cases where the judge hears it and jury trials are becoming quite a rarity.
So,
yes, that's true.
So obviously I think you, Karen, come out of this with confidence in the jury system?
I have a lot more confidence in the jury system than if we were to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. I have to say that we went all the way through a trial, and the jury hung. From what I hear, our case was pretty unusual because the jury hung, and while the jury hung and took a lunch break, the prosecutor put another offer on the table. And what they said is that if our son didn't take the offer, and I'm sure the law professor here is going to understand that there were some things that were highly irregular. They said they'd spoken with the judge, and the judge assured them, excuse me, sorry, that he would not dismiss the case. And the prosecutor assured us that they would retry the case, even if it hung 11-1. right there, you know, something's wrong. They're not supposed to be talking with each other, but, you know, things don't always happen the way they're supposed to. They said, take the deal right now, or we're going to come back with much more serious charges with attempted murder. Otherwise, take the deal and he can have 3 years. One thing that people don't consider is at that point, we either took the deal or we would pay for another trial. And trials cost tens of thousands of dollars to mount. Theoretically, you have access to a public defender, but I would be interested if a law professor could give me any statistics on how often a public defender will actually go to trial in a non-capital case. And again, I think it's going to be not very often.
I'm not a lawyer. My primary area is sociology, and I work in the law school and teach in there. So I wouldn't be the best expert on some of the very specific issues. But, you know, your sense of the pressure to plea and the fact that so few cases do go before a jury and that these cases are very expensive and as you say, required you to hire your own attorney to have confidence in that counsel, all those things are very consistent with what I know of the system.
Well, Karen, appreciate you sharing your story. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate that. That does bring up some very interesting points, which we've responded to in part here, but I wasn't aware of that, the vanishing trial.
Yes, very much so. You see this, you sometimes hear about this in these arbitration clauses that appear in contracts, employment contracts, even consumer contracts that you don't even know you're signing, where or agreeing to, where embedded in that language is if you have a dispute with us, you're going to go before an arbitration board rather than to trial.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been upheld, and we're seeing a lot more private kinds of litigation on the civil side. And on the criminal side, obviously, we're all struggling with limited budgets and the need to do more with less, and I think that puts pressure on all kinds of systems to efficiently process cases, and of course a plea bargain is more efficient than a trial. So I just think I have to say the vanishing trial is we don't quite know what's going on. There's a lot of scholars scratching their heads to try and figure it out. But that certainly has been a number of different pressures to take away formal trials.
And certainly the expense. You could see how some people, I'm sure including Karen, would feel like that having to bear that expense means you maybe can't get justice.
Yeah, I think we have, you know, it's certainly a fair critique of our system that it's a very expensive way of doing things. Mm. And that, you know, the adversary system that we have is based on the notion of two kind of equal parties who, you know, go at each other and fight out the case. Not all lawyers are equal. And not all lawyers are equally good. And so it sometimes does require, we have some excellent public defenders, but sometimes in some regions, in some areas, it does require private counsel to get the kind of depth of experience that you want for your son or your child or your family member.
I wonder back to the Roman trial and perceptions of justice.
Mm-hmm.
In a case like this, what can be done to perhaps restore perception that justice is being done?
Well, I know that jurors are not don't want to talk to the media, and they don't have to. Sometimes it does help to hear from them. Sometimes, of course, they might speak and you're scratching your head even more. But I think understanding the diligence that they brought to the decision-making process, understanding the grave responsibility that they felt, even understanding that they went in with a pretty sizable minority having doubts. You know, that tells you something right there. So to the extent I think that we can learn more about juries and the jury process, I think sometimes that does make us feel more comfortable with the system, because the experience these jurors are describing is quite consistent with what we know, that jurors try to do a good job but have to have a story of the evidence that doesn't have a lot of holes in it.
Hmm.
And it's pretty thorough. And they're trying to construct a story that has the best coverage of what they've heard. And if they can't do that, the instructions tell them to be conservative and acquit.
Just have a couple of minutes left. I'm interested in this Pima County study in Arizona, a study of, I think, 50 deliberating juries. You were
civil cases.
You were an investigator in this. Just your thumbnail sketch of it. Any surprises come out of that for you, or any, you know, the bullet points of what we learned from that study?
We're still working on and continuing to analyze this very rich data set. I would say that the diligence comes across very much in the way that juries talk about their case. If I can just briefly say why we have this information.
Yes.
Arizona allows their civil juries to talk about the evidence ahead of deliberation as long as everybody's in the room and as long as they don't make up their mind. So the idea here is if you've got a long trial or even a complicated trial, that there are opportunities on the breaks to check in with each other to see if you're following it all along. Because we know that people are thinking about the case as it goes on. They're not potted plants that just take in evidence and don't have any thoughts about them. And so in civil cases, Arizona allows jurors to talk with each other. But they also know that's pretty controversial potentially, and they wanted to have some documentation that it's being used appropriately and that it's a solid reform. And so they allowed researchers to come in and install videotapes with the jurors' permission, with the party's permission only, in a number of cases, and record what happens during those breaks and then during deliberations. And a random set of cases didn't discuss the case ahead of time, and they rested. And so we have thousands of pages of transcript on jury decision making, and I think this notion of how much they want to get it right, even if it's a few thousand dollars from a car accident, is significant. I think there is a preference that Arizona allows non-unanimous verdicts in civil cases. I think even given that, juries like to be unanimous. They like to reach consensus. They sometimes, turn on the argument, turn on the desire for reaching that. But generally, they're very respectful and want to get a group that all feel good about the verdict.
Very interesting, and then you say that that investigation is ongoing. You're still gathering.
We're in the last phases, and we hope to have a book out soon.
Oh, excellent! Nice. We'll be interested in that. Well, we've reached the end of our time. Murray Rose is associate professor of sociology and law at the University of Texas. Studies how juries reach their decisions. We've been responding to our latest, very prominent jury trial, which reached a not guilty verdict and has some in Utah concerned. Mary Rose, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. We hope that you will join us tomorrow for Sherry Quinn and Science Questions, Access Utah Science Topics. That's tomorrow on the program. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Life moves quickly in Utah's fastest-growing county, and as a member of Utah Public Radio's news team, I will keep you up to date on the latest news in Utah County. I'm Stephen Tanner, one of many reporters covering events happening in your neighborhood. For the latest in politics, science, arts, and religion, tune in to Utah Public Radio. Everything that matters to you matters to us. UPR, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.